Hello, it's Friday the 20th of August. I'm Richard Spur for Andrew Pearce, coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up on today's show, calls for Dominic Raab to resign continue to build as more details emerge about the phone call he delegated. Trophy hunting hits the headlines again as a protected Zimbabwean lion is killed by an American hunter with a bow and arrow. And should we all give up housework? But first, third jabs of coronavirus vaccines are being rolled out. Why do we need them? And who should have them? Coronavirus vaccines are due a top-up, with Sajid Javid having said that booster shots for some groups could start next month, following in the footsteps of countries such as the United States and Israel. But some say that the third shot is unnecessary. Well, Paul Hunter, professor in medicine at the University of East Anglia, joins me now. Professor Hunter, why are we talking about a third jab?
Well, I think there's essentially three reasons why you might want to be giving a third booster shot at this stage. The first is that the people who had the first two doses didn't respond well enough. And we know that people, particularly with some severe diseases, and possibly as well our older members of society, won't necessarily have responded as well to vaccine as we would have liked. And I think that group, there's very little doubt that a booster dose will provide real benefits. And in that, I'm thinking about anybody who perhaps is over 80 or somebody with being treated for cancer on immune suppressive therapies, those sorts of things. And I don't think there's any doubt about that. The other reason why you might want to be giving boosters is because the protective effect that the vaccines, or indeed natural infections, have given before is starting to wane. And we do know that there is good evidence that the vaccines are not as good, even after a few months, at preventing infection as they were fairly soon after somebody had received the second dose. Now, it's not an absolute thing, but certainly over the course of perhaps a year, we're thinking that maybe half the people who would originally have been protected against infection by the vaccine will have lost that protection. But, and this is the big area of debate, is that actually we do know that protection against severe disease almost certainly lasts a lot longer than protection against infection. So the vaccines seem to be still very good at protecting against severe disease. The third issue is because the new variants, and particularly the Delta variants, aren't as effectively controlled by just two doses of vaccine as we would like, as certainly as the alpha. And again, there is good evidence of this, that infection with the Delta variant is more common in vaccinated, even doubly vaccinated people, than we would have expected if we'd still predominantly had just the alpha variant. But again, this issue about protection against severe disease is still true, in that even if you have a Delta variant, the best evidence at the moment is that you are still highly protected, and probably as highly protected as you would have been if it was the alpha variant.
Would you say that there was an ethical or moral dimension to perhaps giving third doses in the UK when some people in other less developed parts of the world haven't even had one?
Absolutely, and certainly, you know, I think we've got to the point where most people actually working in the area of infection and immunology of infectious diseases have accepted that this virus isn't going to go away and that vaccines won't ultimately stop the spread of this virus. And so if we are giving vaccine to people who are still protected against severe disease in this country, that those vaccines aren't going to be available for people who are still to receive their first doses, which are going to protect them from severe disease and possibly death as well. So And that is certainly a big, strong issue. And it's one of the reasons, I think, why the World Health Organization have been fairly against the idea of booster vaccines, apart from special cases up until now.
And just briefly and finally, are we all going to have to keep on taking boosters for the rest of our lives?
I don't think so. The last big pandemic of coronavirus that we had, we believe, was about 130 years ago. And actually, within about 3 or 4 years, that virus, that pandemic, shifted from the very high death rates that we've seen in this pandemic to being effectively just another cause of the common cold. And you know, nobody's going to be vaccinating repeatedly throughout life for something that effectively will only just cause the common cold. So I personally don't think there will be a need for repeat boosters for years to come. But clearly, you know, we're going to have to see how the disease progresses over the next year or so.
Very good of you to join us. That was Paul Hunter, Professor in Medicine from the University of East Anglia. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Dominic Raab refused to take a phone call while he was away on holiday as Afghanistan fell to the Taliban, leading to calls for his resignation. Well, today, the Daily Mail exclusively revealed that the call that he said was passed to a junior actually went unanswered. Well, John Stevens is the Daily Mail's deputy political editor, and he joins me now. John, why did this call never happen?
Well, this was advice that the Foreign Secretary got last week, last Friday, that he needed to make the call. You know, his advisers were very clear it needs to be him to make the call rather than a junior minister. But we finally heard from Dominic Raab this afternoon, and he's saying the whole of government's been working tirelessly over the last week. And he said that even though he was it was recommended to him that he made the call, it was delegated to a minister of state because he was prioritising security and capacity at the airport. So he's saying that, you know, he was doing other things, he was busy. It wasn't that he was lazing around on a beach, that he had other things to do.
How much pressure is he under now from his colleagues and from the media?
Well, I think we all know how Boris Johnson operates. We've seen over the last 2 years, whenever his ministers have been in trouble, he's been very reluctant to sack them. The only person who really got sacked was Matt Hancock, and that was after days of Boris Johnson trying to cling on to him. So Boris Johnson doesn't want his ministers to be pushed out. He's very stubborn about that. And I don't think we're going to see Dominic Raab either resign or be sacked in the next few days. But I think when it comes to the next cabinet reshuffle, I think that's when you're going to see Dominic Raab being very vulnerable, and I think he's expected to be demoted. But, you know, speaking to Tory MPs over the last couple of days, they say he might be able to ride it out for, you know, the next week or so. The problem will come once the flights back from Afghanistan stop. You know, they're expecting that lots of the Afghan interpreters who bravely served our troops in Afghanistan might not be able to make it back to the UK. And the concern of Tory backbenchers is if you start seeing the Taliban going around people's houses, rounding them up, beheading them in the streets, Dominic Raab won't be able to say that he pulled out all the stops when he could to try and get them back to the UK.
And doesn't this reflect slightly badly also on the civil service, that this was allowed to, well, not happen?
Yeah, and you know, we found out last night as well that a lot of senior civil servants are actually on holiday. So it wasn't just Boris Johnson off on holiday last weekend and Dominic Raab on holiday in Crete. It was also the three most senior civil servants in the Home Office, the Ministry of Defence, and also in the Foreign Office. And those are obviously the three departments have been responsible for trying to get people back from Afghanistan.
That was John Stevens, the Daily Mail's deputy political editor. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all of our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and more. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at MailPlus or me at The Spur Show. 6 years after Cecil the Lion's slaughter by an American trophy hunter made headlines around the world, another American has killed another lion from the same protected park. The lion was shot with a bow and arrow, where Will Travers is executive president and co-founder of the Born Free Foundation. Will, why has trophy hunting managed to get itself back into the news sadly again?
Well, I think, Richard, thanks for having me on. And it seems like it does seem strange to be discussing things like this when the world is in such turmoil. But lives are being lost, and wild animal lives are being lost to trophy hunters. Cecil caused this seismic, the killing of Cecil 6 years ago, caused this seismic earthquake of emotion around the world. People were just outraged at the thought that, you know, someone of privilege, someone with enough money, could take the life of a magnificent lion, and we would all be, in a sense, deprived of the opportunity, if we could ever afford to go there, of seeing Cecil. And now the same has happened, as you say, with Mopani. And these spikes of interest that happen, particularly when an animal, a magnificent animal like a lion, is, as I understand it, lured out of a safe area, right onto the fringes of that safe area, in fact, in the very location where Cecil was shot, and is then killed, and not killed cleanly, with a bow and arrow. I don't know what it is. I think we are revulsed by it. And I think the mistake is to think that this is a sort of unique, it only happens once every few years incident, when actually it's a lot more pervasive than that.
It may sound obvious, Will, but how is this allowed to continue?
Well, there are a number of sort of justifications for it, and perhaps we can explore them. The proponents of trophy hunting will say that the killing of in their view, a relatively modest number of animals, in my view, a huge number of animals, as trophies for fun, generates resources for African or other communities around the world, that it provides employment opportunities, and that it helps secure marginal land that would otherwise not be protected for wildlife and that might be converted for other use. And I think we can explore all of those, the economic justification, the employment justification, and the ecological justification for an activity that the great majority of people, certainly in this country, 90% of the public, are opposed to the killing of wild animals for fun.
Is there any justification that this is some form of conservation?
Well, let's look at that. So let's first of all just look at some of the numbers. We are talking of hundreds of thousands of wild animals every year killed for fun. We're talking of thousands of lions. Looking back over the records of organizations like Safari Club International, which is one of the big hunting organizations in America, you'll see that literally thousands, tens of thousands of animals have been killed by hunters from that particular country. In fact, they actually award awards for species, the number of species you've killed. So if you want to get the Global Hunting Award, Richard, I'm not suggesting that you do, but you would have to kill 17 African species, 13 North American species, 4 South American species, 6 European, 6 Asian, and 4 Southeast Asian Pacific species. So 50 species will get you the Safari Club International's Global Hunting Award. It is sort of incentivizing this particular activity. Now, to this point about conservation, there are proponents who will claim that taking those animals' lives and paying a significant amount of money to do so means that money goes into the conservation of the habitat, of all the other species that are there, and provides employment opportunities. I would question this quite fundamentally. We know from research done by organizations like Economists at Large in a published report in 2013 that there is a trickle-down effect. You know, it would be wrong to say that no money ends up at community level, but how much? And by their estimation, it's around 3 cents in the dollar. So for every $100 spent on trophy hunting, around $3 ends up at local community level.
it would also be wrong to say that nobody gets employed in this. And I've seen estimates of around 50,000 people across Africa who are employed in the trophy hunting industry. You have to just compare that with, for example, the 1.6 million people who are employed in the wildlife tourism sector in Kenya alone. And look at the quality of the jobs as well. In Kenya, where I've been many times, I meet lodge managers, people who own companies. These are Kenyan, African Kenyans at the top of their profession. If you look at the trophy hunting industry, it is dominated by expats, non-natives, to put it bluntly, white members of society. And the jobs that are then available are relatively low-level, low-paying, and sometimes just seasonal jobs going to local people. So I think that the conservation and economic claims of those who support trophy hunting are greatly, greatly exaggerated.
In my view, some of the less agreeable aspects of life do tend to come from the USA. Is this purely an American problem?
No, it really isn't. America is, without question, the biggest actor on this stage in terms of where clients come from and where the money is. But almost every sort of Western country, but including Russia and Mexico, Canada, U.S., much of, if not all of Europe, are involved in this, and increasingly Chinese trophy hunters as well are involved in this. You're right, it's a pretty distasteful activity, I think, to take this enormous pleasure, this moment of, I mean, it's been likened to having an extraordinary orgasm, and it's on the record. When you pull the trigger and the animal is killed, there was the really quite bizarre incident in 2009 where A.A. Gill, you know, famous journalist in this country, more famous for his reviews and his restaurant critique than anything else, shot a baboon because he wanted to, quote, see what it was like to feel what it was like to shoot a human. Bizarre doesn't do it justice.
Well, Adrian did have some very odd characteristics. It's true, despite his acclaim. Just finally, is there anything that the individual in society can do to try and curb this tide of murder, really?
Well, there's an important thing here, and that is that we, you know, in the UK, cannot tell countries like Tanzania or Botswana to stop trophy hunting if that's what they want to do. If that's what the government allows and permits in those countries and others, then they can do that. But equally well, we can voice our concerns here, and we can look to our government to reflect those concerns. And thankfully, when it comes to trophy hunting, following a government consultation, which Born Free participated in fully, the government has declared that it will introduce a ban on the import of trophies, of hunting trophies, into this country. They haven't told us when, and they haven't told us which species will be covered by such a ban, but I hope that it's very comprehensive. And that is what we can do where we are a sovereign nation, and other sovereign nations will, I'm sure, follow suit once the UK pins its standard to the mast. So I think we can all do something, and the main thing is to make sure that we express our distaste and disgust for this, and then call on our governments to look for alternative ways of funding, innovative ways of funding the conservation of habitats and wildlife, so that the species that we treasure so much don't lose out.
Will, I'm very grateful for your taking the time, and I remember with great fondness the film which gave your organisation its name. That was Will Travers, Executive President and co-founder of the Born Free Foundation. This week, Rod Stewart's wife, Penny Lancaster, admitted that she never did housework, something which up to 8% of people in Britain agree with. Well, business coach Lisa Johnson told the Mail this week that she's too busy to deal with housework and pays for a cleaner and gardener for her stay-at-home husband. She joins me now. Lisa, do you do that with any degree of guilt?
I feel no guilt whatsoever. I run a business and I believe that that should require my attention more than a bit of cleaning.
Your husband stays at home. Has he not got time to, you know, don a penny and wave a feather duster around occasionally?
Yeah, so he does a bit. So he does do the in-between kind of clearing up, cleaning, cooks for the kids, does their packing up, takes them to the dentist, all of that kind of side of things. But he also sometimes helps me with the business, and so it doesn't make sense for him to be doing everything. So we just found it was much easier to get somebody else to do the things that we can, you know, make more money in the business doing, and pay somebody else, which I think helps the economy. And so I feel good about it.
When did you decide that housework simply wasn't for you?
Well, when I was growing up, I had to do quite a lot of housework. I was in a single-parent household with my dad, and so me and my sister shared all the chores and all the things we had to do because my dad was working so hard. And so when I got to a position where my business was making enough money, the first thing I outsourced before I did anything else was the cleaning, because I knew I didn't want to have to do it if I didn't have to.
How much does it cost you, though, to pay these people to do the stuff that you don't want to do?
So let's put that into perspective. It costs me around £15 an hour. I make around £250 to £400 an hour. So it doesn't make sense for me to spend my time doing that for an hour when I could be making a lot more money.
Well, you're a very fortunate woman. But many people will listen to this and think, well, I'd love to be able to delegate all of this and to pay for domestics, but simply can't afford it. They're going to view you with some degree of jealousy, I think.
Maybe, but then I think it gives everybody, if everybody thinks, well, what do I really want to strive for in life? What are the things I would like to not do? And then tries to make it happen, tries to make sure that they can afford it, then it can change things. You know, I was in a position only 4 years ago where I was £30,000 in debt, but I knew I didn't want to be in that position. And so I found ways to be able to start my own business to make money so that I don't have to do all these things anymore. Otherwise, I would have to do them too.
I'm like you. I absolutely hate doing housework and washing up of any sort, particularly vacuuming, is a real bugbear. Some people, though, really get a bit of a kick out of it.
Yeah, I get that. But I'm the kind of person that, like, if I had to clean the house, I'd start cleaning one thing and then I'd spend an hour just making the taps look really good or something, like making everything too perfect and the rest of it would just still be rubbish. So, I get how people like take real good pride in cleaning their own houses and in making things look good. And I do think it's therapeutic. We see from things like Mrs. Hinch online, it's therapeutic. It can help people with anxiety and all sorts of things. I think it's a good thing to do if you love doing it, but I don't love doing it. I'm not going to do it.
Some people, though, take it to a different level and actually quite obsessive about it. You've seen that obsessive cleaners program on the TV. I think some people can take it a bit too far, can't they?
They can. And I think it's, although I'm a little bit OCD about being kind of, everything has to be neat and tidy, I think if you go too far with it, it's showing an underlying issue.
And just finally, one reason why many people don't like having cleaners in is because they're quite protective, maybe understandingly, about their own privacy. They don't like the idea of someone they don't know that well snooping around. Does that not worry you?
I don't mind it because I have a really good relationship with my cleaner, but I totally do understand that. And, I work from home, and so it can be a bit weird, while I'm working, having someone sort of cleaning in my own house. That's always felt a little bit weird to me. But, going to my office and close the door if I feel a bit strange about it. But I have to remind myself that if we don't pay other people to do these jobs, they don't have those jobs.
Well, you're quite right.
So it's important.
One way of looking at it is that you are generating employment, I suppose.
I'm helping the economy. Like, the more that we can move money around, it's helping the economy. That's how I see it. That's why there's no guilt.
Well, I've got to go and scrub my hob, so I'll love you and leave you. But many thanks for joining me. That was Lisa Johnson, business coach and strategist. Thank you. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to this all over again. I'm Richard Spur, and Andrew Pearce will be back on Monday. Until then, have a great weekend. Bye-bye.